Welcome once again to Glam City, where we take you behind the scenes of Sydney's cultural scenes. We're going to bring you history in your backyard from across Sydney. GLAM is that great acronym that stands for Galleries, Libraries, Archives and Museums. Hello, Anna Clark.
G'day, Tamsin Peach.
And today we want to welcome Nathan Sentence. He's a proud Wiradjuri man who has a library degree and works at the Australian Museum as a project officer for First Nations cultural programs.
Nathan, I'm going to try this without embarrassing myself. Nadu Ninyal Gawem Banadu. And this is where I'm welcoming you in Wiradjuri, yeah. I hope.
Thank you. Mandangu.
We should also say before we get started that we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and waterways on which this place to SER is located, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Why is it important to acknowledge country when we're presenting information and events?
Because I think it's always important to acknowledge that we are, wherever we are in Australia, it is Aboriginal land. It has been Aboriginal land probably since time immemorial, since human history. You know, it's not just a gesture of niceness, it is a sort of remembrance sort of thing to acknowledge that this land has long been Aboriginal land. And and I think it is important just to sort of, you know, to sort of keep that into people's minds. I think that's mainly what it is like a reminder that we are on Aboriginal land and the waterways, the nature around us have been cultivated and protected by for tens of thousands of years by the local Aboriginal people of the area.
You're a project officer for the First Nations Cultural Programs at the Australian Museum and currently secretary of the Australian Society of Archivists in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Special Interest Group. Mm-hmm. And you've also won the Loris Williams Memorial Scholarship in 2015. Your Twitter profile, I think, is also really interesting. You say that you're interested in the Indigenous intellectual property, construction of social memory, Indigenous epistemology, rugby league, yes, go the Jets, films, theatre, metadata, which is more interesting than it sounds. Can you give us a little bit of an introduction
to
yourself?
We've got to plug his handle.
Oh, yeah, sorry. At Say What Nathan. I should feel like I should be saying that with an American. Say what, Nathan?
That is actually how it's meant to be said.
And we found you on Twitter.
Yeah. As a lot of people do. I get asked, randomly, I get asked for things like this and asked to be on panels and stuff like that from Twitter rather than other things that I do.
From your actual job.
Yeah.
It's also your blog, which is great. I mean, go together.
Yeah. But yeah, with those things like, well, Aboriginal epistemology, I'm talking about sort of Aboriginal knowledge systems. Something like the Australian Museum, which is considered a natural history museum, works a lot with Western knowledge and Western science, and I'd like to incorporate Indigenous science into that, but not just incorporate, but also in a way that's not tokenistic or sort of, or even exploitative, more like in a way that validates Aboriginal knowledge and puts it in the same sort of area or like, a respectable reverence as Western science, because, you know, Indigenous knowledge has sort of kept Australia sort of sustainable for a long time, and globally you see Indigenous science from like the Native Americans or the First Nations Canadians, and people sort of using that information now to learn more about the world and about themselves and how to actually maintain the world. Yeah.
This is an anecdote, which apropos of your comment there, I've been doing some research on the history of fishing in Australia, and one of the things I've been reading recently was from an explorer actually in Wiradjuri country, and he talks about walking past rivers and that the guys he was going with were throwing lines in to the water, and that he was saying that the Wiradjuri people were standing on the riverbanks laughing because they had just fished there.
Yeah.
So there is and he writes this in his diary that these, you know, they were all laughing and that they, you know, that this exploration party really didn't know what they were doing or talking about. So there has been an acknowledgement of Indigenous knowledge of this country for a long time. It's not just something that's happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah. But there's also been like a big sort of forgetness of Aboriginal knowledge as well. Like one of the stories I like to talk about, because it's like not just a Sydney story, but it's a Sydney woman story, is about in Eora, while men fished, they used to fish on the sides. The people that would go out into the water and fish were the local Gadigal women, and they actually had the fishing knowledge, and they were actually considered like, you know, the holders of the fishing knowledge. But when Europeans first came, they actually asked the men, because they assumed from, you know, the gender roles in Western society, that's how it would work in, Aboriginal societies. So they didn't actually, and lost out on a lot of sort of, you know, keen fishing knowledge because of that. But then they started fishing, and one of the stories I recently read, which I kind of like, was about sustainability. The way Aboriginal people fished was like not gluttonous, you know, they'd fish for themselves, or they'd also fish seasonally, so they would give time for fish to replenish. But Barangaroo, which that place is named after, she once saw these European men sort of fish and took about, you know, 200, like it was like just this big bag of fish, more fish than the people around. And she nearly broke down in tears because she just thought it was so gluttonous and wasteful, and it's probably ruining the waterways for a little time being. So, yeah.
I'm fascinated by this notion of forgetting because, you know, you talk about museums and galleries and libraries maybe and archives as memory institutes, but there's also this silencing that they have affected. And you describe yourself as an archival decolonist. I mean, can you talk about what that means in the context of memory institutes?
Well, I think memory institutions have a long time have been privileging certain voices. Even with, say, with the Australian Museum, Gadigarang, our Sea Country exhibition, which is a beautiful exhibition, that was the first exhibition in 190 years of collecting Aboriginal and displaying Aboriginal objects that was actually curated by Aboriginal people.
Wow.
So if you think about that, like Aboriginal stories have long been not told, and then when they have been told, they've been told from European perspectives, which have had, you know, repercussions. Like one of the problems too is, like, say with the Australian Museum or most natural history museums, when they present First Nations people, they present them from an anthropological point of view. And because they don't really understand First Nations people, they present them, you know, they'll use terms like primitive, savage. And what it does is actually dehumanises Aboriginal people to the punters that go through. Mm. The punters go through, see this, see these institutions as, you know, they're the primary sources of information, so they should see them as reputable. So once they hear that, see that, they can be justified in also dehumanising Aboriginal people. That's one of the issues we've sort of... these sort of places. And it isn't just museums, it is art galleries presenting Aboriginal art as sort of outsider art. It is archives only collecting and prefacing the written word, which has, you know, long sort of excluded Aboriginal people, and libraries doing the same, or, like, you know, even sort of like academic research, you know, academic archives keeping research on Aboriginal people, but it's done by non-Aboriginal people. And it's sort of, again, so because people will continue to go back to these sources. So if you go through historical sources as a, like a non-Indigenous person, if you went through these sources, you'd be getting the story of Aboriginal people from non-Indigenous people, and it sort of continues itself on. Like, and it does leave out a lot of voices, and it also does leave out lots of bit of, like, culture and perspective and stuff like that. Like, one of the stories I like to always think about was, like, a story that Kirsten Thorpe, the archivist and also the head of Indigenous Services at the State Library in New South Wales, she was telling me that when she used to work at State Records of New South Wales, they have the reserve records there. So people would go there, stolen generation people would want to read their records about themselves or their family, and they would read these records and be like, this is wrong, like, I was there. But the thing is, you know, these aunties and uncles that will have these stories, these lived experiences, won't be as considered as valid as a written record, which... even a written record has its own agendas and biases. Even if it was a government record, they have a reason.
Especially if it was a government record sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing that happened in South Africa with archivist Vern Harris talks about too, where he talks about how when he tried to make an apartheid museum, and one of it was his research into South African archives, and he was just like, well, this doesn't actually tell the full extent of the oppression. Like, they, because, you know, these oppressive forces aren't going to write these horrible stories about themselves, you know what I mean? But again, because they're government and because we have a weird view of this idea of objectivity, and, like, we sort of try and talk about history without pluralism, we try to talk about there's only one true history. Because we do things like that, it does lead to this idea of objectivity, and we put so much privilege on sort of these written words or these written documents or, you know, this certain anthropologist or... whereas, you know, especially with, like, academia, I find it funny that, you know, someone can be a doctor in, like, Aboriginal weaving, but then the Aboriginal weavers themselves aren't, you know, doctors in their own right.
I guess that sort of knowledge, you could call it even the colonial apparatus of Australian knowledge, is revealing in itself of what colonialism can do. Yeah. And I was, just to bring you back to that exhibition you sort of mentioned very briefly, that's the first exhibition curated by Aboriginal people. And what did the punters think of that? Did they sort of respond?
It's actually one of our most well-received exhibitions. It's a beautiful exhibition. It's one of our most well-received ones since it's launched in 2014-15. Yeah, it's been really well attended. It's one of the ones that school groups asked to come to see, because it actually sort of, it's past the sort of simplistic view of Aboriginal people, so it goes a little bit further and has a little bit more depth to it.
And is that what's noticeably different about it? I mean, if you were to put sort of exhibitions side by side.
Yeah, you can sort of see it still. Biala Noora, which had a lot of, had an Aboriginal co-curator, but it was still curated by a non-Indigenous person. Biala Noora means yarning country in the Sydney language, and that's the one next to Gadigarang. And they're both good exhibitions. Biala Noora is like a good example of diversity of Aboriginal culture. But still, you can kind of look at it and you see like even the little labels, they'll say things like, they'll have things in the scientific speak like wood, resin, bark string, this sort of stone. Mm. Where with Gadigarang, there's the little captions might have a little bit of that stuff, but it will actually have like first person perspective on things. So not just having objects, but connecting objects to people and connecting objects to culture. Like, cause yeah, objects are sort of, without their sort of culture, they're sort of meaningless. Like, they're not meant to be sort of scientific. What's it called? Curios? They're not meant to be scientific curios. They're meant to be parts of culture and how culture manifests itself.
I mean, you have this wonderful quote from an auntie in your blog. Museums have the sticks, we have the stories. Without the stories, museums only have the sticks.
Yeah, and it's true, though. That's the truth. Like, and that's what's an issue with sort of museums and libraries and stuff like that, too. Like, libraries might, or archives might have language material, but they don't have the meaning behind the words, or they'll have, you know, stone axes, but they don't know really what they're used for, and their database entries will have these very, you know, scientific descriptions of them, but they won't actually... They don't have a human connection to them, and they're meant to be used by people. They're meant to have this story behind them. They're meant to be sung to. They're meant to be danced with. So we just sort of need that more into the museums, because it's like if we're only capturing the object and preserving it forever without that stuff, there's no real point. We're not capturing the full story of it, and we're not really capturing what it's for. Like, it will just continue being a scientific curio if that's the case. Like, isn't this interesting? Look at it. Yeah.
So in museum speak, correct me if I'm wrong, there's material culture or tangible heritage and intangible heritage. Is that what you're getting at with that term, intangible heritage?
Yeah. But I think they should be combined. They should be one and the same. Like, and again, too, like, yeah, with what I was saying, too, we need that stuff, too, to connect them back to people. We can't continue looking at cultural objects as stuff from outsiders. Because, you know, Aboriginal people are Australians like everyone. It's just part of their culture, and we need to look at it not as like a weird outsider culture. It's part of their practices. It's a manifestation of culture. And
do you think that that combining of stories with artefacts is something that non-Indigenous museum practitioners or GLAM practitioners could also apply to non-Indigenous objects? Would that be could you bring an Indigenous lens or to some of those non-Indigenous cultural artefacts?
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, I definitely do. I was even talking to someone just recently, and they were talking about even in art galleries, a lot of the art galleries have these, you know, these small little captions, and they'll have like the artist's name, and unless you know the artist, you don't really like worry that much. But she was saying that with her exhibition that she did down in Victoria, like an Aboriginal photography exhibition, she actually sort of put pictures of the people next to them, or if she couldn't get a picture, she'd have like a quote from them. And she was just saying that just connects you more to what's happening, just to the maker. And I think that's important. Like, one of the coolest things I actually did get to experience while I was in Canberra recently was the traveling tea mag, the Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery exhibition, Unbroken String, which is about shell necklace making from Tasmania. It's like a Tasmanian cultural practice for women, like Pakani women, and I think a lot of other Tasmanian women do it too. And one of the coolest things they did was they did exactly that because, first of all, they did it because they thought it would be boring just to have each little caption say shell, string, resin, and it would all be the same thing. It might be slightly different shells. So they decided to have quotes instead. And one of the other things they did that was really cool is they had a lot of it was commission stuff. It was a lot of it was part of a project to revitalize their thing. So it was a lot of people who was, you know, did it, and they were just new artists or, you know, revitalizing the culture. But they actually took some out of their collection to to show the comparison. And this is the coolest thing I haven't seen it in another museum before. But say with our museum, when we show an object, and a lot of our objects were, you know, gotten through trade or gotten through anthropologists' collections, and they don't actually cite the maker. So it will say something like maker unknown or artist unknown. In this one, they actually, with the necklaces where they don't know who made them, they said made by ancestor.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was a much more meaningful kind
of... It's peopling it, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what that's a long way about what I'm saying is that's what I just want to do is like connect it to people. Like people made these things and this is part of people's lives, yeah.
I mean, how does it feel when you see that descriptor in the archival catalogue? Maker unknown.
I really don't like it because it is a reminder of how things sort of got into collections and how little, how little they valued this Aboriginal knowledge because they didn't even care to sort of take names and stuff like that of the people who made it. It's sort of a gripe of mine.
Yeah. And maybe it also reveals how they were taken anyway.
A lot
of things were taken without the maker's consent.
Yeah. So, yeah, there is a reminder of that kind of stuff.
I went to the South Australian Art Gallery a few years ago and saw, you know, what they'd done is paint the walls, the blank walls of, I don't know if you saw this, with, I think it was some body markings from the local Kauri people. Mm. And so the entire walls of the museum were painted with these markings, which just enacted in this very visible way that there is no blank space.
Yeah.
And it was really, and so these European pictures sat against this context and they looked totally different as a consequence. It was really wonderful. Because there's a lot of blank space in a museum.
You're listening to Glam City on 2SER 107.3. To download this show, head to 2SER.com or your favourite podcast app and look for Glam City. This pod is made by the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS with support from 2SER. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes because it helps other people find us. You've got a terrific blog, as we mentioned before, Nathan, and one of the things you wrote recently was on the Captain Cook controversy, Cook Monument controversy, which has been certainly the topic of conversation between Tamsin and me in recent weeks, and also historians all around the country and in public, of course. Your contribution was critiquing some of the debate and also putting forward an alternate list of five things more sacred than Captain Cook statues that are under threat. Can you tell us what they are, if you remember, and also why you contributed to the debate with these particular items?
Again, this one was because of a gripe.
All good blog posts.
And radio shows.
And radio shows, yeah.
I think I picked the Bunyip Peninsula up in sort of the Kimberleys because it has the first face print of a human in the world. So it's not just part of like Australian history, it's part of world history. Yeah.
And it's under threat.
Yeah, that's the thing. There is a little bit of controversy, but I feel like I'm in my own little echo chamber of people who are angry about it. I feel like the broader Australian society is not going like, don't hurt the bunny. Like, it's part of human history. It should be preserved forever. Same with the Awabakal Butterfly Cave, which is a woman's meeting site, which is very important to a lot of people don't understand, I think, when they talk about Aboriginal culture, the fact that country is important. Like, that's why a lot of culture wasn't just lost through assimilation policies. It was actually lost through land dispossession because there are certain words, certain things that you only really connect to the land that you're on. And that's why places like the Awabakal Butterfly Cave are important because it's a women's meeting site. And it's probably the same place where they will do knowledge transference is in that
where
spot.
Where is it?
I don't know where exactly it is because it's meant to be private.
Sure, but in terms of the geography of...
Newcastle. Like, right. Awabakal is sort of like Newcastle, a little bit north Newcastle, okay. Awabakal, sort of that area. So, yeah, so it's kind of around there. And while it's actually technically it's heritage listed, which is one of the things that I find is weird, but it's still under threat from building development. And, like, one of the issues too is it's private property. So not only do these Aboriginal women have to, protect it, they also have to ask permission to go on it, which I think is very weird because they want their privacy and they don't want to have to sort of ask every time they need to access it. So, yeah, so that's the thing under threat. And there's a few others I did. oh, yeah, what's it called? It's come back up in the news just recently, the Tasmanian, the Tarkin area. So, and that's got the, that's like, you know, I was talking to Zoe Rimmer, who works at TMAG, the Tasmanian Museum, and she's a Parkinie woman. She was talking about an art piece in Defying Empire that happened at the National Gallery, and it was connecting to that Tarkin. And you could just see how emotional she got about it, because it just is so important to Tasmanian Aboriginal people. So the idea that you can sort of just drive over it with four-wheel drives and stuff like that, especially when knowledge is embedded in the landscape. And lastly, I did another one, but lastly I also chose like Aboriginal children, because it is a very scary, when you hear statistics, it's actually a very scary sort of thing. Like, and when things like, you know, just recently with like Elijah and the poor lady in Cessnock who died in custody, and just continues happening, and the child removal in the NT is really horrible. The intervention itself has sort of caused a sort of a juvenile justice boom in Northern Territory, and all these sort of things are, while they're not interconnected, I just think it's something we should bring up when we sort of talk about this, because, you know, a lot of this unfortunately does come from, I think, from whitewashing of history again, I think. And this idea that I fear that in, you know, I think the intervention is like one of the worst things that's happened in recent history, but I want it to be remembered as such. Like, if we go, like, I want it to end first, but also too, I want it, like, if historians would, you know, reviewing it in 50 years' time, I want them to look back and see how horrible it is. But if we're like arguing about statues, I'm worried about how that would progress. Like, yeah, how, if we can't budge on something as sort of tacky as these, like, these inaccurate statues, how could we budge on other topics like that? So yeah, and yeah, sort of perspective wise I was just like, yeah, these statues are sort of, in the context of everything, they're sort of meaningless compared to sort of the threats that Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander children are facing at the moment.
Yeah, connecting that past injustice to the current politics seems also part of the role of memory institutes. You were talking before about how frustrated you get when the archive has got, you know, a white European name, but it's talking about, or it's collected Indigenous material. What role do you think the digital can have in kind of giving credit to the makers?
I think that's, like, it's one of the coolest things that the digital opportunities present, like digital archives, digital archival systems like Western Australia and Northern Territory, State Library of Western Australia, and I can't remember, I think it's maybe the Land Council up in Northern Territory. They use a system called Ariecha, which allows community to have a special login, which allows them to actually add to the metadata. There's also another system from the US called Mockachu, which again does the same thing, where you can sort of give a login to a community group, and it also stops gatekeeping as well. What you do to them, and they can look through, you can just donate all the stuff. Like, if you went to like Walgett, you can donate to the local Walgett community, give them all their stuff digitally. They can add this thing called community narrative, which adds to the metadata. But what they can do with that is, it doesn't have to be written word. They can also do a video or audio recording to add to it. So it adds more metadata and adds more interesting metadata. But at the same time, what they can do is they can choose what stuff gets public, which stuff is private to their community, which stuff is only private to elders. And because of that, it actually takes access policies out of institutions' hands. Like, we really shouldn't be gatekeepers to some of this cultural knowledge. And we want, I know for a fact that most community cultural institutions, memory institutions, don't want to be gatekeepers. They don't want to have access restrictions. They just don't know how to go about it. And something like Mokatu and Ariecha might alleviate that, because you can sort of consult with the community and then sort of just digitally repat their stuff, and then they control it. But also, one of the cool things about Mockatoo too is, yeah, again, it can add to that metadata. Things can be sorted. We don't have to have them sorted in the way they're physically sorted in the building. You know, we might have all this language material under like someone like William Dawes, like, but we don't actually have to have that. Like, on the digital, they can actually do it by language group, do it by, you know, place. And one of the other things too is, like, on our systems, we geographically, you know, organize material, but we geographically organize material through white sort of colonial names. So that's one thing they can do. They can organize their material by places, sites special to them. So that's one of the cool things that I think the digital offers, these opportunities that the physical just can't at the moment.
Do you think that those new ways of storing and collecting and classifying information through actual, you know, Aboriginal country, for example, yeah. or communities being able to control the knowledge, you know, in some instances for the first time, I'm guessing, will that put pressure on institutions to change the way they think about their own knowledge? Not to suggest that, you know, the museums or the libraries are, as you say, deliberately gatekeeping. Often there's a lot of goodwill there, but can this digital push influence a change in the ways institutions hold their information and make it accessible?
I think so. I think so too. And I also think it also helps too with even just with like the way things will be organised and stuff like that in digital by Aboriginal people. Would also be interesting for people that work in cultural institutions to actually see how Aboriginal people would organise information. One of the things too is even with our information that we assume is open access, like stuff that we're just like, oh, well, we've digitised it. We've digitised all this language material so communities can access it. First of all, communities probably don't know we have it. And then when they search it, we have a convoluted sort of, you know, controlled vocabularies, whatever, like the systems that have worked for, you know, decades. But in the same way, like, I'm not going to, like I would, but like say my dad, if my dad wanted to look up Wiradjuri language, he probably wouldn't search the catalogue for Dubbo, or he wouldn't search for Wellington. He wouldn't search for, you know, all these different, he wouldn't search by these European names, or he wouldn't search for languages. He would search by Wiradjuri, or he'd search by, you know, other things that he wouldn't, that would connect to him. So we need to sort of make that more, because even if we think we're being open, we don't realise that our, and this is the same with sort of history, our neutral is sort of not the same neutral as other people's.
The goalposts have been shifted.
Yeah. But we think we're being open. We think we're being, you know, we think we're being inclusive, but in the sense we're making everyone do things our way, which is not inclusive.
I'm getting the sense that these are some of the reasons you think metadata is much more interesting than it sounds.
Because it's what describes stuff. And then I guess too, the way we describe stuff is also the way it's from the European perspective again. And again, it sort of does the same sort of issues. And
yeah, it's where the power is.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll move to Glam Slam. Glam Slam is that part of the show where we talk about what's coming up in our diaries. And maybe, Nathan, you could tell us a bit too what's coming up at the museum.
Okay, so things that I'm working on the 21st and 22nd of October, I'm running modern Aboriginal meditation workshops with Milan Dion. They're these cultural practitioners up from Central West New South Wales. And what they do is they, we call it meditation because that's easier to explain, but really it's like a cleansing ceremony and a storytelling session. So what happens at the start is you do like sort of dancing, songs, and what it's about is sort of cleansing out the bad spirits and bringing in the good spirits. Everyone that does it leaves so very sort of relaxed and sort of, oddly connected to nature, even though they're in a colonial building in the middle of the CDB. They sort of get connected to the country. So very excited for that. And then also in November, we're doing, I think it's on the 14th and 15th of November, I think we're doing Adorned. It's about expressing identity through jewellery making. So what we're going to do is we're going to make necklaces, bracelets, earrings, but using natural materials. And that's kind of really cool because one of the things too is a lot of this material is stuff people walk past and they don't realise its value.
And people get to take these home?
Yes, that's part of it, yes.
Fantastic. Do they have to book?
Yes, they for all those things they book and it is ticketed, so there is like a fee to it.
Language, culture, all in one.
How about you, Tamsin? And what's on your glam calendar this month?
Well, I'm going to buzz off to the Sydney City Farm Working Bee, B-double-E, because last episode we were talking about boots on as historians and I thought it was time to get my gloves on, gardening gloves that is. Sydney City Council holds volunteer working bees at a city farm in St Peter's. So I am going to check out the What's On page of the City of Sydney website, which tells me where that is in October.
In fact, everybody should be checking out the What's On in City of Sydney page to find out not just about working bees, but also other working bees.
To buzz off to.
That brings us to the close of Glam City for today. If you'd like to hear more from us, head to the 2SER website at 2ser.com. And you can also search for us in your favourite podcast app. And don't forget to hit us up on Twitter. You'll find me, Anna, under @AnnaHopeClark, and you,
I'm at cap underscore and underscore gown, which is not the most sexy Twitter handle.
This podcast is made by the Australian Centre for Public History with the support of 2SER 107.3. If you want to get in touch, you can also shoot us an email, glamcity@2ser.com. Thanks.
And thank you, Nathan.
Mandanguru. Thanks to Nathan Sentence from the Australian Museum for being our guest today, and we'll see you back next week for more glam conversations.
Glam out! That's such a weird ending. Thank you.